Welcome, everyone, to another episode of Law and Religion Down Under, a podcast devoted to exploring the interactions between the legal system and faith in the South Pacific. I'm your host, Jeremy Patrick. Normally on this show, I interview a particular guest from across the spectrum of ideological and religious views, and we discuss a particular issue along those lines. This episode is going to be a little bit different, however. In this episode, I want to discuss an interesting topic that has arisen to the fore in the US, especially over the past year. And it's something that I've written and studied and published about in the past as well. So I have a particular interest in it. And this topic is the role of the so-called nuns in the religious freedom debate. Nuns are a list or a title, I guess, given to a increasingly large segment of the population in most of the major Western democracies that have disclaimed a formal religious affiliation. And there is, of course, a wide variety of individuals who may identify under that rubric. They may be true atheists or agnostics, but the vast majority have some sort of spiritual belief, even if it's not a spiritual belief that is associated with a traditional religion. Sometimes they're called the SBNRs, the spiritual but not religious. And often their beliefs are idiosyncratic and individualistic in the sense that they've chosen these beliefs. Maybe they've assembled or cobbled together a variety of beliefs from a variety of traditions, spiritualities, philosophies, sometimes science or pseudoscience. One of the aspects of the situation that is fascinating and that has led to a lot of debate is, should nuns be able to make claims under constitutional guarantees of freedom of religion? There has been a couple of conferences about that in the United States in the past year and some special journal issues. And One particular writer on the topic is Professor Mark Movsesian of St. John's University in New York, who is also the director for the Center of Law and Religion there. And Professor Movsesian has written a new journal article called The New Thoreaus that will be published soon in the Loyola University Chicago Law Journal. And I thought it'd be good to take this opportunity to talk a little bit about my own work on the topic in the context of sort of providing a rejoinder to what I think is an excellent article by Professor Movsesian, but we come to polar opposite views. So it might be something different, something a little bit fun to use this episode of the podcast for a perhaps a more selfish purpose, but I think it's a topic that many people will find interesting, and I hope you get something out of it as well. So what I'm going to do is read a extract from my book, Faith or Fraud, Fortune Telling, Spirituality, and the Law, that covers this exact topic. And then as a sort of aftermath to reading that, provide some reflections on Professor Movsesian's paper. And what I think hopefully you may find are some persuasive counterarguments that will at least continue the debate, if nothing else. Okay, so I'm going to go ahead and start reading this extract, and I will put links to this extract, which appears as part of an edited collection in a separate volume, as well as to Professor Movsesian's paper. So you can compare and contrast and, of course, make up your own mind about which view you find the most persuasive. My piece is titled A la Carte Spirituality and the Future of Freedom of Religion. Introduction. This chapter discusses the important emerging dilemma of what might be called freedom of religion at the margins. The archetypal religious freedom claimant is a deeply serious, long-standing member of a religious organization who is faced with an agonizing decision to follow the dictates of God or the laws of man. When judges and legal scholars think of religious freedom, they may think of such iconic issues as Jehovah's Witnesses refusing blood transfusions despite the risk of death, the Amish gaining an exemption for their children from compulsory school attendance, or Jewish prison inmates demanding kosher meals. With the sanctity of conscience given great weight, courts in major Western liberal democracies have developed expectations that those claiming protection in this context must be sincere in their beliefs, that those beliefs must be recognizably religious, and that, nonetheless, important government objectives may still trump the exercise of religious conscience. These judicial expectations, in turn, are then reflected in the types of questions claimants are asked and the types of evidence they are expected to provide. Of course, if the idealized religious claimant has certain identifiable characteristics, it is also easy to imagine the opposite. Litigants that will never succeed on a freedom of religion claim because their beliefs in the relevant context have no religious connection whatsoever. The courts have always made it clear that freedom of religious exercise is guaranteed, not a general freedom to take actions that may be motivated by purely secular philosophies, political views, and so forth. To go down this path would lead to anarchy, according to the U.S. Supreme Court, because, quote, the very concept of ordered liberty precludes allowing every person to make his own standards on matters of conduct in which society as a whole has important interests, end quote. Between traditional religious beliefs and clearly secular ones, however, there are those that are much harder to label because they seem to contain elements of both. This may seem in line with the trite observation that in any process of legal classification, there will be difficult cases. However, there is strong evidence to believe that the difficult cases are going to become more and more common because the nature of religion and religious belief is changing in the West. Although institutional religion continues on, there has been a dramatic increase in the past 20 years in those who describe themselves as spiritual but not religious, SBNRs. The common trait among SBNRs is that they take an individualistic approach to religion, picking and choosing particular beliefs from a wide variety of religious traditions, and then adding in, on an a la carte basis, notions from what may be derided by many as folklore, pseudoscience, the New Age smorgasbord, or personal intuition. Legal scholar Rebecca French calls this grocery cart religion and summarizes it well. Quote, a grocery cart religious practice has only the rituals and ethical boundaries that the practitioner explicitly agrees to take on. Instead of following a revealed canon, the individual fits the interesting parts of different religions together into a structured, personal spiritual practice, end quote. Thus, SBNRs lack many of the criteria associated with traditional religious freedom claimants. They may not belong to an organization, follow an authority figure, or have easily accessible or easily articulated beliefs. They may change their beliefs frequently, apply them in practice intermittently, or even describe those beliefs as constituting something other than religion. Christopher Partridge calls this trend one of the most significant developments in Western religion over the past 50 years, noting that, quote, there is in the West a move away from traditional forms of belief which have developed within religious institutions towards forms of belief that focus on the self, on nature, or simply on life. There is a move away from a religion that focuses on things that are considered to be external to the self, God, the Bible, the church, to spirituality, that which focuses on the self and is personal and interior, end quote. The rise of this so-called new spirituality presents challenges for the traditional application of religious freedom principles in liberal democracies. The thesis of this study is that although such beliefs are easily dismissed as dilettantism or half-baked, judges tasked with adjudicating religious freedom claims should approach these beliefs with as much compassion, respect, and deference as is given to more traditional forms of religion. If our understanding of religious freedom remains static, while religion itself continues to evolve, one of the fundamental rights of liberal constitutionalism may gradually become hollow for future generations of believers. The three jurisdictions referred to in this chapter, Canada, Australia, and United States, formally approach religious freedom quite differently. In the United States, the First Amendment's guarantee of free exercise of religion has been held not to apply to valid and neutral laws of general applicability. That is, unless legislation singles out religion for special disadvantage, no relief from an indirect burden on religious exercise will be granted. However, this general rule is riddled with exceptions that complicate and often undermine it. In Canada, the guarantee of religious freedom of religion in the Charter of Rights and Freedoms is more advanced while maintaining clarity. a non-trivial burden on religious freedom, as with a burden on any other right protected by the Charter, must be justified as demonstrably necessary in a free and democratic society. The Supreme Court of Canada has given content to this rule by setting out a multi-step balancing test. Australia is the wild card in this deck. Although the Commonwealth, the federal constitution, contains a guarantee of religious freedom modeled quite closely on the First Amendment of the United States Constitution, subsequent interpretation by the High Court of Australia has rendered it a virtual nullity, and no litigant before that court has ever successfully invoked it to obtain relief. However, the High Court has given content to the meaning of the word religion in the Constitution that has often been adopted as authoritative by courts interpreting statutory bills of rights and human rights or public accommodation legislation. The goal of this chapter is to analyze whether traditional notions of freedom of religion apply to the spiritual but not religious as a step towards understanding the future legal evolution of this fundamental right. All right, three tests. Despite their differences, courts in all three countries examining religious freedom claims will usually consider the sincerity of the claimant, whether the claimant's beliefs are religious in nature, and whether an individual's right to religious freedom is outweighed by important governmental or societal concerns. These three considerations serve in this chapter as a framework for evaluating the application of traditional freedom of religion principles to individual spirituality and are thus worth some extended description. We'll start with sincerity. Courts in Canada, Australia, and the United States expect that a litigant asserting a claim premised on a constitutional or other guarantee of religious freedom sincerely holds the religious beliefs that have led to a conflict with man-made law. However, a formal inquiry into sincerity is not always necessary. Frequently, it will be quite clear from the circumstances of the litigation that no claim would have been brought in the first place if the claimant were not sincere. It is difficult to imagine why a non-Jew would litigate to wear a yarmulke while in military service, or a non-believer subsidize the expense of a lawsuit just to wear a Khalsa Sikh turban while a member of the Royal Canadian Mounted Police. However, when religious freedom claims are brought that would provide an exception from a widely shared burden, or an advantage that is normally not provided to others, courts grow understandably skeptical. An exemption for a limited number of sincere, religiously motivated pacifists from conscription may be manageable during wartime, but an exemption from conscription for anyone who simply claims to be a pacifist could clearly lead to abuse and undermine the war effort, since the burden of military service is quite high. The issue of sincerity comes to the foreground most clearly in cases involving so-called religious fraud. Instances where prosecutors assert that fraudsters have set up sham religions as a means to prey on the gullible. The major American case in this respect is United States versus Ballard, a Supreme Court decision stemming from a mail fraud prosecution. The defendants in Ballard had established the IM movement, in which they purported to be divine messengers able to communicate the words of ascended masters, such as Saint Germain, and stated that as part of their supernatural gifts, they had the power to heal otherwise incurable ailments. The defendants sold literature and solicited donations from IM believers before being charged. The trial court judge had instructed the jury that the truth or falsity of the asserted claims was irrelevant, and that instead the jury should consider whether the defendants honestly and in good faith believed those things. After the jury returned a guilty verdict and the defendants appealed, the Court of Appeals ordered a new trial so that both the prosecution and defense could have an opportunity to demonstrate whether the miraculous claims were in fact true. The Supreme Court, however, held that the First Amendment prohibits the truth or falsity of religious claims from being considered by the courts. In memorable words, the court stated, quote, "Men may believe what they cannot prove. They may not be put to the proof of their religious doctrines or beliefs. Religious experiences, which are as real as life to some, may be incomprehensible to others. Yet the fact that they may be beyond the ken of mortals does not mean that they can be made suspect before the law." End quote. The court's strong statement that the validity of religious beliefs is immune to legal examination is reflected in other jurisdictions. Justice Murphy, for example, in the Australian High Court's Church of the New Faith case, wrote that, quote, "The truth or falsity of religions is not the business of officials or the courts. If each purported religion had to show that its doctrines were true, then all might fail, end quote. Similarly, the Supreme Court of Canada has stated that, quote, claimants seeking to invoke freedom of religion should not need to prove the objective validity of their beliefs, nor is such an inquiry appropriate for courts to make, end quote. When it determined that the veracity of religious claims could not be tested by the legal system, the U.S. Supreme Court in Ballard left an implication that the sincerity of religious claimants could still be examined. Although controversial to some, this implication was accepted by lower courts in subsequent religious fraud cases. In United States versus Rashid, for example, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals examined a mail fraud prosecution that was similar to that in Ballard in many respects. The defendant was the founder of the Church of Hakim and its Dare to Be Rich program, one of the central beliefs of which was the law of increase, or the law of cosmic abundance, which provided that if one gave freely, one would receive returns greater than the initial gift. In essence, the Church of Hakim proclaimed that any donations it received would be repaid four times over after a set period of time, dependent on the size of the donation and so-called psychic birth cycles. In the eyes of prosecutors, this was simply a classic pyramid or Ponzi scheme dressed up with religious language. In considering the defendant's claim that their activities were absolutely protected by the Free Exercise Clause of the First Amendment, the Ninth Circuit hewed closely to the distinction implied in Ballard. The truth of the law of cosmic abundance could not be tested, but the defendant's sincerity of belief in it certainly could be. Because evidence demonstrated that the defendants knowingly lied about the true source of the money they were distributing to contributors, the court had no difficulty ruling that their insincerity was clear, and therefore the convictions should stand. The appropriateness of an inquiry into the sincerity of religious freedom claimants is settled. What creates difficulty, however, is determining how that inquiry should proceed. In other words, what questions are allowable and what evidence is determinative? The task must be handled carefully, lest it set standards that mainstream believers are not equally held to or result in derision of seemingly strange or novel beliefs. In an article on religious fraud, one writer named 11 different factors considered at one time or another by American courts and legal scholars assessing sincerity. The types of evidence analyzed can be sorted into three categories. One, those pertaining to the individual believer. Second, those pertaining to the group he or she belongs to, if any. And third, those pertaining to the beliefs themselves. So those relating to the individual could include actions inconsistent with professed beliefs, willingness to bear adverse consequences of the religious belief, an alternative secular purpose, the intensity of the believer's devotion, the defendant's testimony and statements relevant to the defendant's religious sincerity, the coexistence of secular fraud, previous case law on the defendant, the religious organization, or the religious belief, evidence of the defendant's attempts to cover up embarrassing or questionable activities. And evidence relating to the organization could include size and history of the religious organization, and whether the challenged tenet is part of an organized faith of which the defendant is a member. And last, evidence relating to the beliefs themselves could include the extent to which the claimed beliefs parallel traditional beliefs. Reckless application of some of these factors could lead courts in a direction that is not consonant with religious liberty. The first factor, for example, if applied too strictly, could arguably lead to the vast majority of believers in even traditional religions being disqualified. Quote, occasional deviation from Sabbath observance does not prove full-blown hypocrisy, just as occasional indulgence at a non-kosher restaurant ought not to preclude all claim of need for a kosher diet, end quote. A strong case could also be made that some factors should simply not be considered at all. Whether others believe the same things the claimant does, for example, threatens to turn religious freedom from an individual right into a purely associational one. Still, these are some of the considerations that must be addressed in determining how religious freedom guarantees interact with individual spirituality. Examining the list given, it becomes clear that SBNRs, the spiritual but not religious, will struggle with many of these factors. For example, it could be difficult to prove the intensity of their devotion to spiritual beliefs that have changed or evolved in the believer's eyes multiple times in recent years. There will not be, by definition, canonical statements of faith, established ecclesiastical history, or fellow members of the organization to testify to the SBNR's sincerity, because there is no canon and no organization and no fellow believers. There will most likely be no previous case law or academic studies on the believer's precise set of beliefs, though it is quite possible that particular aspects of those beliefs can be traced to well-known origins. The mutable mixture of the supernatural and the secular, or scientific, in the beliefs of many SBNRs may strike judges as a tool of convenience that allows them to alter their faith to fit their litigation needs. It may be that the best an SBNR can hope for is the strength of their own credibility on the witness stand, and perhaps that of friends or family members who will testify that the SBNR takes their own beliefs seriously. On the other hand, a judicial test of sincerity is not an inquisition, and the benefit of the doubt is usually given to litigants unless there is clear evidence of bad faith. Even though many of the spiritual but not religious may not express themselves with theological sophistication, their beliefs need not be eloquently stated, nor even internally consistent, in order to be sincere. Although inevitably some scam artists will use freedom of religion as a shield and get away with it, my view is that the actions of the fraudulent few should not be used as a reason to deny the obvious sincerity of millions of believers whose spiritual lives depart from the norm of institutional religion. Section 2.2 of this chapter is on the definition of religion. It is a truism that a valid religious freedom claim requires a belief or act with a nexus to religion. The related guarantees in the First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, Section 2A of the Canadian Charter, and Section 116 of the Australian Constitution all make use of the term in articulating the scope of the proclaimed freedom. Even apart from constitutional claims, significant social and statutory benefits are available for belief systems classified by the government as religious in nature. However, the provision of such constitutional protections and statutory advantages requires a legal articulation of what type of beliefs count as religious. The requirement of a legal definition of religion is driven both by fidelity to constitutional and statutory text, and by the pragmatic recognition that if anything and everything is considered religious, then the government's ability to provide special protections and advantages will be undermined. Unfortunately, the task of articulating an acceptable definition of religion has proven to be a vexing one for both courts on the one hand and anthropologists on the other. In a recent case deciding that Scientology should be considered a religion under English law, Lord Tolson of the UK Supreme Court wrote, quote, "There has never been a universal legal definition of religion in English law, and experience across the common law world over many years has shown the pitfalls of attempting to attach a narrowly circumscribed meaning to the word. There are several reasons for this: the different contexts in which the issue may arise, the variety of world religions, developments of new religions and religious practices, and developments in the common understanding of religion due to cultural changes in society." Nonetheless, courts in the United States, Canada, and Australia have articulated legal definitions of religion. Given the complexity of the task, it is not surprising that those definitions vary, sometimes in quite significant ways. The definitions provided have been the subject of great controversy, and legal scholars have not been shy about adding their own contributions to the debate. Two major approaches to defining religion can be found in the relevant jurisprudence and scholarship: a functional approach and a content-based approach. A functional approach looks at the role played by a certain set of beliefs in the lives of those who adhere to them, and asks whether that role is akin to that played by traditional religious beliefs in the lives of their adherents. In contrast, a content-based approach extracts certain hallmarks or features that are widespread among beliefs commonly understood to be religious in nature, and asks whether the set of beliefs in question share all or many of those features. In United States versus Seeger, the United States Supreme Court adopted a functional approach when asked to interpret a statute allowing for conscientious objection for military service. The Universal Military Training and Service Act allowed for exemptions from service for those opposed to all wars on the basis of, quote, religious training and belief, end quote. This phrase was then defined elsewhere in the statute as meaning, quote, an individual's belief in relation to a supreme being involving duties superior to those arising from any human relation, but not including essentially political, sociological, or philosophical views, or a merely personal moral code. End quote. The court was faced with the task of applying the definition to would-be objectors, who each held what might fairly be summarized as individually formulated and idiosyncratic religious beliefs that did not include the concept of God in a traditional sense. Because lower courts had interpreted the statutory phrase, belief in relation to a supreme being, narrowly, the defendants had been denied exemptions and convicted of failure to report for service. The Supreme Court reversed the convictions, however, by holding that the statutory language must be understood in a functional sense. Quote, within that phrase would come all sincere religious beliefs which are based upon a power or being or upon a faith to which all else is subordinate or upon which all else is ultimately dependent. The test might be stated in these words, a sincere and meaningful belief which occupies in the life of its possessor a place parallel to that filled by the God of those admittedly qualifying for the exemption comes within the statutory definition. End quote. There are sound reasons to limit the weight of Seeker. First, the court was engaged in statutory, not constitutional interpretation, and drew heavily on past versions of the statute and congressional reports and debates in reaching its conclusion. Second, a close reading of the case indicates that the court did not provide a functional definition for religious training and belief, which might allow for a useful analogy to free exercise claims, but instead a functional definition for belief in a relation to a supreme being. Thus, the court was able to take it for granted that the appellant's beliefs were both sincere and religious in nature, and only had to decide whether those beliefs were, for statutory purposes, equivalent to a belief in a supreme being. In a sense, this creates a problem of recursion, because an argument exists that the distinction between religious and other beliefs is still not articulated clearly. In other words, Seeger establishes that the non-theistically religious fall within the statutory definition. It does not answer the question of what it means to have religious beliefs in the first place. Third, and crucially, the court was able to take it for a given that all of the defendants were sincere in their beliefs and articulated those beliefs in self-professed religious terms. The more difficult issue simply did not arise for decision. Despite these caveats, commentators and lower courts have taken Seeger to stand for the general proposition that, for constitutional and other purposes, religion has a functional definition in U.S. law. When a question arises about religion, what religion means, Seeger is a favorite starting point for analysis. In order to balance what could be an extremely broad definition, scholars and judges are also prone to quoting a passage from a Supreme Court case decided 7 years after Seeger. In Wisconsin versus Yoder, the Supreme Court ruled that Amish parents had a constitutional right to withhold their children from otherwise compulsory high school courses. The Amish parents' opposition to secondary schooling was clearly based on deeply held beliefs, and there was no question that those beliefs were sincere and religious in nature. In upholding their claim, the court noted in passing that non-religious beliefs would not require the same accommodation. Quote, to have the protection of the religion clauses, the claims must be rooted in religious belief. Although a determination of what is a religious belief or practice entitled to constitutional protection may present a most delicate question, the very concept of ordered liberty precludes allowing every person to make his own standards on matters of conduct in which society as a whole has important interests. Thus, if the Amish asserted their claims because of their subjective evaluation and rejection of the contemporary secular values accepted by the majority, much as Thoreau rejected the social values of his time and isolated himself at Walden Pond, their claims would not rest on a religious basis. Thoreau's choice was philosophical and personal rather than religious, and such belief does not rise to the demands of the religion clauses. End quote. Although obiter dicta in the purest sense, the passage from Yoder creates tension with the functional test announced in Seeger. If Seeger tells us to take a broad view of religion as encompassing beliefs that fulfill the same role in believers' lives as traditionally understood religious beliefs play in the lives of their adherents, but Yoder tells us that, nonetheless, philosophical and personal rather than religious beliefs fall outside this definition, there is clear ambiguity. This is precisely the apparent paradox relied upon by the Fourth Circuit a few years ago when it determined that the veritable smorgasbord of beliefs held by a fortune teller named Psychic Sophie were not religious in nature. One can fruitfully contrast the functional definition provided under U.S. law with the content-based definition favored by the High Court of Australia in the 1983 Church of the New Faith decision. As with the more recent UK Supreme Court case, the issue in Church of the New Faith was whether Scientology should be considered a religion. In three separate opinions, five members of the court proffered legal definitions of the word. Unhelpfully, no single view gained majority acceptance. The first opinion, written by Acting Chief Justice Mason and Justice Brennan, explicitly rejected the functional approach adopted in the United States, stating that such an approach focused on the questions raised by a set of beliefs rather than the answers they proposed, thus improperly allowing room for self-professed non-religious doctrines with no relationship to the divine or supernatural to fall under the definition. Instead, Mason and Brennan proposed an apparently simple content-based test. Quote, "We would therefore hold that, for the purposes of the law, the criteria of religion are twofold. First, belief in a supernatural being, thing, or principle. And second, the acceptance of canons of conduct in order to give effect to that belief." End quote. A second opinion, written by Justices Wilson and Dean, favored an approach that involved a non-exclusive list of indicia of religion, quote, "derived by empirical observation of accepted religions," end quote. In discussing the list, the two stated that, quote, "it is unlikely that a collection of ideas and or practices would properly be characterized as religion if it lacked all or most of them, or that if all were plainly satisfied, what was claimed to be a religion could properly be denied that description," end quote. Five common characteristics of religion were identified. Quote, "One of the more important indicia is that the particular collection of ideas and or practices involves belief in the supernatural. That is to say, belief that reality extends beyond that which is capable of perception by the senses. If that be absent, it is unlikely that one has a religion. Another is that the ideas related to man's nature and place in the universe and his relation to things supernatural. A third is that the ideas are accepted by adherents as requiring or encouraging them to observe particular standards or codes of conduct, or to participate in specific practices having supernatural significance. A fourth is that, however loosely knit and varying in beliefs and practices adherents may be, they constitute an identifiable group or identifiable groups. A fifth is that the adherents themselves see the collection of ideas and or practices as constituting a religion." End quote. Justice Murphy, writing alone, offered the most inclusive definition of religion. He rejected as unacceptable many of the criteria used by the Supreme Court of Victoria in determining that Scientology was not a religion, including its commercial aspect, lack of public acceptance, lack of a code of conduct, lack of consistency in beliefs, and willingness to allow members to simultaneously be members of other faiths. Instead, Murphy stated that, apart from obvious hoaxes, any group that professes to be religious should probably be treated as such by the state. Quote, "The better approach is to state what is sufficient, even if not necessary, to bring a body which claims to be religious within the category. On this approach, any body which claims to be religious, whose beliefs or practices are a revival of or resemble earlier cults, is religious. Any body which claims to be religious and to believe in a supernatural being or beings, whether physical or invisible, such as a sun or the stars, or a physical invisible god or spirit, or an abstract god or entity, is religious. Any body which claims to be religious and offers a way to find meaning and purpose in life is religious. The list is not exhaustive. The categories of religion are not closed," end quote. The legacy of the three opinions in the Church of the New Faith case is unclear. Carolyn Evans states that the two-part Mason-Brennan test, quote, "is the one that has most commonly been taken up in other legal contexts and in which a definition of religion has been required," end quote, and has become the, quote, "de facto definition for religion when it comes to statutory definition," end quote. In the recent English Scientology case, the multiple indicia approach of Wilson and Dean was favored, reflecting the modern legal tendency to eschew bright-line tests in favor of contextual analyses where various factors can be weighed. Justice Murphy's liberal approach is arguably the best suited to an age of tremendous religious diversity and innovation, and one of the examples he provides is probably the most analogous to the issues discussed in this chapter. Quote, "If a few followers of astrology were to found an institution based on the belief that their destinies were influenced or controlled by the stars, and that astrologers can, by reading the stars, divine these destinies, and if it claimed to be religious, it would be a religious institution," end quote. An important element of both the Mason-Brennan test and the Wilson-Dean indicia is whether the belief system involves the quote-unquote supernatural. As Sadursky notes, quote, so much hinges upon the concept of supernatural in the Church of the New Faith case as the test for discriminating between religious and non-religious beliefs that we must have some degree of clarity about what it means, end quote. Sadursky suggests that the term is used in the case, quote, encompasses two related philosophical notions, a metaphysical concept of the transcendental order, transcending the bounds of individuals and of the physical world, and an epistemological concept of non-empirical or extra-empirical cognition, available to humans by means other than through the mediation of our senses and reason, end quote. Sadursky criticizes reliance on the concept of the supernatural, noting that many of the theologians and belief systems embraced by a functional approach might fall outside its ambit. Turning to Canadian law, the Supreme Court of Canada has never squarely faced the question of what constitutes a religion. The leading attempt, although dicta, comes from the court's 2004 decision in Syndicat Northcrest. Quote, defined broadly, religion typically involves a particular and comprehensive system of faith and worship. Religion also tends to involve the belief in a divine, superhuman, or controlling power. In essence, religion is about freely and deeply held personal convictions or beliefs connected to an individual's spiritual faith and integrally linked to one's self-definition and spiritual fulfillment, the practices of which allow individuals to foster a connection with the divine or with the subject or object of that spiritual faith, end quote. Arguably, this definition contains elements of both a functional and a content-based approach. In noting that the definition is consistent with a personal or subjective conception of freedom of religion, one that is integrally linked with an individual's self-definition and fulfillment and is a function of personal autonomy and choice, the court echoes somewhat the role approach taken by the U.S. Supreme Court in Seeger. On the other hand, the repeated reference that protected beliefs must be spiritual in nature, or pertaining to the divine, might be seen as analogous to the requirement stated in some of the Church of the New Faith opinions that religion requires belief in the quote-unquote supernatural. Quote, religion is one of those words people tend to feel they know the meaning of until it comes to providing a precise definition that covers all cases of what one wants to call religion, excluding everything else. Then it can be surprisingly difficult to define, end quote. Nonetheless, jurists continue to strive to define the slippery concept of religion, and their efforts must be grappled with in order to determine whether individual spirituality will be protected by religious freedom guarantees. One issue is that, whether or not it should be relevant, courts and legislatures often pay particular attention to whether an individual's beliefs are shared by a like-minded community of believers with which that individual associates. In this vein, Ian Barber writes that, quote, a religious tradition is not just a set of intellectual beliefs or abstract ideas. It is a way of life for its members. Every religious community has its distinctive forms of individual experience, communal ritual, and ethical concerns, end quote. For example, the statutory exemptions from fortune-telling laws in most American statutes only apply to individuals who are members in good standing of incorporated religious associations. Spiritualism, an organized institutional faith that has existed for over a century and includes temples, tenets, and regular worship services, now fits very clearly into most judges' ideas and most legal definitions of religion. And activities done under its auspices will likely satisfy this aspect of the three-part test of freedom of religion. But an SBNR who draws inspiration from, for example, so-called New Age beliefs will be in a far different situation. Quote, a major difficulty with understanding New Age is that it does not conform to traditionally understood forms of religious organization. It is neither church, sect, cult, nor denomination. While the various forms of established religious models may apply to particular groups or organizations that identify with the movement, they remain unsuitable for describing the movement as a whole. There is no list of New Age creeds and no registrar of membership, end quote. We generally think of freedom of religion as both an individual right and an associational one. It is an individual right in that it allows each person to manifest their innermost conscience through outward words and actions. And it is an associational rite in that it allows believers to come together openly and worship publicly. One of the oft-ignored implications of different judicial definitions of religion is the way they can implicitly skew the rite towards individualistic or associational understandings. The U.S. Supreme Court's definition in Seeger, for example, was strongly individualistic, as it dealt with whether an individual's beliefs function subjectively as religion in that person's life. Meanwhile, the quote-unquote empirically derived indicia of religion developed by Justices Wilson and Dean in the Australian Church of the New Faith case included multiple factors leaning towards the associational dimension, such as whether adherents of the belief formed an identifiable group and considered themselves a religion, whether the idiosyncratic spiritual beliefs of an individual are considered religious in any given case may depend on whether the test applied is rooted in institutional, associational understandings of religion, or whether it has been given a more expansive interpretation. It is easy for lawmakers and judges to recognize a church when they see one. It is far harder for them to understand a loose movement like New Age, and harder still, a purely idiosyncratic set of spiritual but not religious beliefs like those adopted by many who have distanced themselves from organized religion. A related issue of importance involves the way in which a person has come to adopt a set of beliefs. Judicial understandings of freedom of religion evolved in a context wherein religion consisted of tenets handed down through generations of believers and then formalized by governing bodies into articles of faith. Although subtle doctrinal differences might not be grasped by lay worshipers, the core principles of a faith are widely shared by its membership. Indeed, the defining characteristic of many religions is the adoption of a particular belief or set of beliefs. We assume, for example, unless shown otherwise in a particular case, that Catholics believe in the doctrine of apostolic succession and that Seventh-day Adventists believe that Saturday is the Sabbath. These formalized, commonly held beliefs are usually widely accessible to outsiders, as most religions are quite happy to share their beliefs with others. When a judge looks upon a religious freedom claimant from a mainstream faith, it is easy for the judge to see that the beliefs in question are not just that person's beliefs, they are the beliefs of an entire body of believers that have been handed down through a traceable institutional legacy. And for mainstream religion, the common assumption is that membership is a sort of package deal. Believers do not get to choose some tenets of the faith and discard others based on personal preference. This all-in style of believing and belonging can give judges assurance that a person is bound by the tenets of their religion and has not cynically adopted a particular one as a litigation strategy. All of these common societal and judicial assumptions are thrown out the window when the beliefs of adherents of the New Age and the self-described spiritual but not religious come under examination. As one scholar writes, quote, "Most of these spiritual philosophies aren't very systematic, but instead appear as a patchwork of ideas eclectically assembled from a variety of disparate sources, whereas most religious writings utilize vocabulary created by centuries of shared theological tradition. Unchurched traditions are more idiosyncratic and tend to imitate faddish trends in popular culture," end quote. Another scholar explains, quote, "The fluid organization or even non-organization of New Age makes it actually more of a consumer phenomenon than anything that could be understood as traditionally religious. It is, in fact, this non-institutional nature and marketing choice of New Age that appears to be its underlying appeal. The New Age is a spiritual consumer supermarket that affirms and celebrates free spiritual choice," end quote. The beliefs of SBNRs have not been formalized by any governing body, cannot be uniformly traced to a particular historical tradition, may appear immature or unsophisticated, and might be swapped out for other beliefs with some frequency. To adapt an oft-repeated analogy, if religion were food, then traditional churchgoers ordered the combo meal from the same restaurant every time, whereas SBNRs prefer buffets and frequently change restaurants. Often, discussions of the difference between adherents of traditional religions and SBNRs carry implied and sometimes explicit criticisms of the latter group as shallow, narcissistic, and flighty. We should resist this lazy urge to stereotype, since it is a manifestation of religious bias as to how believers should act, and it serves to obscure more important issues. Let us move from the abstract to the concrete with the discussion of the case of Psychic Sophie. Psychic Sophie, Patricia Morking, is a self-described spiritual counselor in Pennsylvania. As her activities were defined as fortune-telling under a county ordinance, she was required to obtain a business license, which involved first, the payment of a $300 fee, and second, approval from the chief of police, which, because fortune-telling was a regulated occupation and service, required a criminal background check. Psychic Sophie refused to obtain the license and instead challenged the constitutionality of the county ordinance as imposing an undue burden on her freedom of religion. Both the federal court and the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals dismissed her challenge, finding that her beliefs, although sincere, were not religious for the purposes of the Free Exercise Clause. Before going further, it is reasonable to stop for a moment and ask, why do we care about this case? Does it really matter if a fortune teller in Pennsylvania does or does not have to get a business license? The answer is that it matters because the judicial reasoning demonstrated in the case could be transplanted to a host of other contexts and used as a basis for rejecting claims by the spiritual but not religious that their beliefs are worthy of protection. Psychic Sophie, whose individual and idiosyncratic set of beliefs are drawn from a wide range of sources, including New Age, the Kabbalah, quantum physics, Christianity, astrology, and much more, can be thought of as a stand-in for the typical SBNR. Given the large and increasing percentage of people in the West who identify as SBNRs, decisions like the one made in the Morking case could have significant implications for both spiritual counselors specifically and SBNRs more generally. The judicial reasoning used to deny Psychic Sophie's freedom of religion claim can be summarized quickly. First, the crucial passage of the district court opinions. Quote, in this case, Psychic Sophie states on her website, I am very spiritual in nature, yet I do not follow particular religions or practices, and organized anythings are not for me. I pretty much go with my own inner flow, and that seems to work best. Although that statement leaves room for interpretation, one thing seems clear. Morking follows no religion. It is not as if she claims a mantle of Buddhism, but engages in practices in the name of Buddhism that no other Buddhist believes central to the religion. It is as if she is Lutheran one day, Buddhist the next, and an ad hoc spiritualist the day following. Only, on any given day, she may be all three at once or none at all. Indeed, the sheer number and variety of interests that Morking invokes casts serious doubts upon her claim to religion. Such a panoramic potpourri of spiritual and secular interests does not appear to add up to a religion that can be manifested in practice. This eclectic mix compromises an overall lifestyle, not a belief system parallel to that of God in a traditional religion. End quote. Similarly, the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals wrote, quote, cognizant that defining the borders between the personal and philosophical on one side and the religious on the other presents a most delicate question, we conclude that Morking's beliefs more closely resemble personal and philosophical choices consistent with a way of life, not deep religious convictions shared by an organized group deserving of constitutional solicitude. Yoder teaches that Morking must offer some organizing principle or authority other than herself that prescribes her religious convictions, as to allow otherwise would threaten the very concept of ordered liberty. Yet Morking forswears such a view when she declares that instead of following any particular religion or organized religious faith, she pretty much goes with her inner flow, and that seems to work best. That a wide variety of sources, the New Age movement, the teachings of Jesus, natural healing, the study of metaphysics, etc., inform and shape Morking's inner flow, does not transform her personal philosophical beliefs into a religion any more than did Thoreau's commitment to transcendentalism and idealist philosophy render his views religious. End quote. Morking reflects the tension in American law between cases like Seeger, which offers a functionalist definition of religion, which Psychic Sophie's beliefs seem to fill in her life, and warnings from cases like Yoder, that not every deeply felt belief should be considered religious for the purposes of freedom of religion. The crux of the reasoning here, although drawn from U.S. Supreme Court authorities, reflects a dilemma that is an inescapable part of constitutional guarantees of freedom of religion worldwide. How to protect and value the demands of conscience while simultaneously not allowing believers to become a law unto themselves. Would Psychic Sophie fare any better elsewhere? The answer is a frustrating one. It is unclear. The Canadian definition of religion in Syndicat Northwest contains some elements that would militate against finding that SBNR beliefs are religious beliefs, such as religion typically involves a particular and comprehensive state system of faith and worship. And some language that would support the opposite conclusion, such as a language about religion is about freely and deeply held personal convictions or beliefs connected to an individual's spiritual faith and integrally linked to one's self-definition and spiritual fulfillment. The definitions offered in the Australian Church of the New Faith case are likewise unhelpful. Under the two-part Mason-Brennan test, SBNR beliefs would satisfy the first prong of belief in a supernatural being, thing, or principle, but potentially falter under the second prong, acceptance of canons of conduct in order to give effect to that belief, depending on how strictly canons of conduct was interpreted. If canons of conduct are externally imposed, hierarchically evaluated rules, then SBNR beliefs would fail. But if canons of conduct can include self-imposed, self-evaluated rules, then SBNR beliefs would meet the definition. Under the Wilson-Dean multi-factor test, SBNR beliefs clearly include a, quote, collection of ideas and or practices involving belief in the supernatural, end quote, and that the ideas are, quote, related to man's nature and place in the universe and his relation to things supernatural, end quote. However, as under the Mason-Brennan test, it is unclear whether SBNR beliefs would satisfy the, quote, standards or codes of conduct, end quote, factor, and the fourth and fifth listed factors involving, quote, adherents constituting an identifiable group, and the adherents themselves seeing the collection of ideas and or practices as constituting a religion, end quote. Those may be the factors most unlikely for SBNR people to satisfy. Only under Justice Murphy's expansive definition would someone like Psychic Sophie's beliefs definitely be found to be religious in nature. As the legal literature exhaustively indicates, the limitations of judicial definitions of religion quickly become apparent when applied in concrete cases. In a 2014 paper, legal scholar Mark Nusessian discusses the Psychic Sophie case and whether SBNRs, which he refers to as nuns, based upon how they are usually categorized in surveys, should be included under the umbrella of freedom of religion. Movsesian quite adroitly presents the arguments both for and against inclusion. On the pro side, he lists the foundational principle of state neutrality in matters of religion, the need to prevent discrimination against new and numerically inferior faiths, and societal commitment to respect individual believers and their beliefs. Movsesian writes, quote, "To prevent a believer from exercising his religion thus injures him in a profound way, and the injury occurs whether the believer is part of an organized faith tradition or, like Psychic Sophie, an individual practitioner. For a nun, following one's inner flow might be equally as compelling, equally as essential to integrity and self-respect as a Catholic conforming to the magisterium of the church." On the other hand, he notes that the conventional meaning of the word religion has a shared communal dimension and not a purely individualistic one, that SBNR beliefs are far more difficult to assess for sincerity and seriousness than traditional religious beliefs, and that courts could be pressed to offer exemptions in circumstances that devalue societal respect for freedom of religion overall. Movsesian explains, quote, "The liberal state protects religious exercise in part out of respect for the dignity and happiness of individual believers. Religious commitments are often crucial to a believer's sense of himself and the world, and the state wishes to avoid the psychological damage that may occur if it forces the believer to choose between his religious commitments and civic obligations. This assumes, though, that the believer's commitments are sincere and serious. People cannot expect to receive exemptions on the basis of each passing whim. A sole religious practitioner like Psychic Sophie may be sincere, but how is one to know really whether she is following her inner flow, as she says, or simply seeking to escape county zoning and licensing rules? And what if her inner flow were to change direction tomorrow?" End quote. My view is that although there are risks to including the beliefs of SBNRs as religious for the purpose of constitutional guarantees of freedom of religion, those risks must be taken. The liberal commitment to fundamental rights demands that we give SBNRs the benefit of the doubt and acknowledge and protect their beliefs in the same way and to the same extent as more conventional religious beliefs. Rights such as freedom of religion should be offered in a generous spirit, not a begrudging one. And our understanding of the nature and scope of rights is necessarily an evolving one. To lock in freedom of religion as only applying to conventional organized religions means that the right will gradually lose importance if democratic trends continue on their present course. And this would do a serious disservice to the millions of sincere, even if unorthodox, believers in a spiritual dimension to humanity. Because judicial systems move slowly on a case-by-case basis, the system will have time to recognize and ameliorate any problems that manifest from allowing the spiritual but not religious to find shelter under the umbrella of freedom of religion. Section 2.3 of this chapter is on balancing. The concept of freedom of religion can be usefully divided into two aspects: freedom to believe and the freedom to act on those beliefs. The former can be understood of as an absolute right. One's inner thoughts are as sacrosanct as any interest protected by law. The latter, however, inevitably comes into conflict with other values and goals promoted by the state. Thus, the free exercise of religion is a right that, formally or in practice, is often balanced against other government interests. When courts are faced with the demand to enforce a religious guarantee, they inevitably ask, if not openly, at what cost? This delicate balancing of rights against legitimate state ends underlies the modern approach to rights protection reflected in international law, as well as in constitutions enacted in recent decades, such as that of Canada and that of South Africa. Countries with older rights guarantees, such as the United States and Australia, do not have explicit constitutional directions to balance religious freedom rights with other government interests, but courts in each country still do so in particular contexts. In Canada, the formal legal framework for determining if the right to religious freedom has been infringed is straightforward. The first question is whether the state is responsible for burdening an individual's freedom of religion in a way that is not, quote, trivial or insubstantial, end quote. In its first major articulation of the right to freedom of religion under the Charter, the Supreme Court of Canada in R. v. Big M. Drugmart provided an expansive articulation of how freedom of religion could be infringed by state action. Quote, the essence of the concept of freedom of religion is a right to entertain such religious beliefs as a person chooses, the right to declare religious beliefs openly and without fear of hindrance or reprisal, and the right to manifest religious belief by worship and practice or by teaching and dissemination. But the concept means more than that. Freedom can primarily be characterized by the absence of coercion or constraint. If a person is compelled by the state to a course of action or inaction which he would not otherwise have chosen, he is not acting of his own volition and he cannot be said to be truly free. Coercion includes not only such blatant forms of compulsion as direct commands to act or refrain from acting on pain of sanction, it includes indirect forms of control which determine or limit alternative courses of conduct available to others, end quote. The court uses the term coercion, interference, and burdens on religious practice interchangeably and broadly as forming the trigger for shifting responsibility to the government to justify its actions under Section 1 of the Charter, which guarantees rights subject only to such reasonable limits prescribed by law as can be demonstrably justified in a free and democratic society. The onus on the government to show that its restrictions of an individual's right to religious freedom is a reasonable limit under Section 1 requires two demonstrations. First, that the government has a pressing and substantial objective in enacting the law or taking the action that restricts the right. And second, that the severity of the restriction is proportional to the importance of that objective. Although the formal framework is simple, the balancing process can be complex and divisive in practice because it requires difficult judgments to be made about the importance of government objectives, the availability of alternative policies, and the severity of burdens posed to religious practice. For example, the court unanimously upheld the right of a young Sikh boy to carry a kirpan, a ceremonial dagger, to school, despite the government's strenuous arguments that doing so would threaten school safety. However, in another case, it split 4-3 in holding that the government's desire to prevent identity theft was sufficient to outweigh a Hutterite's refusal to have a photograph of his face on his driving license. The fact-intensive nature of the cases means it's still difficult to predict how the competing claims of citizen and state will be resolved within the settled balancing framework. The legal framework in the United States is far more complicated. Between 1963 and 1990, the Supreme Court applied a form of balancing test similar in nature to that expressed in Section 1 of the Canadian Charter. A substantial burden on an individual's free exercise of religion was unconstitutional unless the government proved it had a compelling interest and chose the least intrusive method reasonably available to achieve that interest. To use an example already mentioned, in the 1972 case of Wisconsin v. Yoder, the court held that the state of Wisconsin's interest in universal education was not of sufficient magnitude to override an Amish community's rejection of high school education for their children due to religious precepts, especially as the community prepared them for adulthood through other means. Quote, the values underlying freedom of religion have been zealously protected in our constitutional tradition, sometimes even at the expense of other interests of admittedly high social importance, end quote. In 1990, this doctrine was upended when the court, in a case called Employment Division versus Smith, held that the Constitution's guarantee of free exercise of religion did not apply to, quote, valid and neutral laws of general applicability, end quote. That is, under the new standard, unless a religious group or religious practice was intentionally targeted by legislation, there would be no need to apply the former compelling interest test. However, this broad rule quickly became littered with exceptions. Cases involving freedom of religion along with another constitutional right, so-called hybrid cases, are still subject to the compelling interest test, as are legislative schemes that already provide for individual exemptions. Some states continue to interpret the freedom of religion guarantees in their own constitutions as demanding the higher standard. Internal church decision-making is protected more stringently than regulation of only outward physical acts. And perhaps most importantly, federal legislation, the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, mandates the compelling interest test for burdens on religious freedom caused by the federal government. For our present purposes, the combination of the general rule with the exceptions means that generalizing about whether divergent belief systems are protected by religious freedom guarantees in the United States is difficult. The situation in Australia is much clearer, albeit in a distressing way for rights advocates. High court jurisprudence has gutted the Australian Constitution's guarantee of freedom of religion by interpreting the provision to apply only if the federal parliament were to pass a law with the specific purpose of infringing an individual or group's free exercise of religion. This is purely a symbolic guarantee, as the court has never found legislation to have such a purpose. Parliament lacks constitutional power to pass legislation of that type in the first place, and if it did, presumably only a tone-deaf legislature would fail to effectively articulate some sort of otherwise legitimate purpose for the law. Regardless, under this doctrine, there is no constitutional context in which religious freedom rights are to be balanced against legitimate government interests. It may be worth noting, nonetheless, that there are some non-constitutional protections for religionists in Australia in certain contexts. Most Australian jurisdictions have religious discrimination laws applicable to government as well as private employers, and some of these legislative schemes require the balancing approach of a reasonable accommodation inquiry. In addition, the states of Victoria and Queensland and the Australian Capital Territory have statutory charters of rights that include religious freedom and a balancing process. The Victorian Charter, for example, echoes Section 1 of the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms by stating, quote, a human right may be subject under law only to such reasonable limits as can be demonstrably justified in a free and democratic society based on human dignity, equality, and freedom, and taking into account all relevant factors, including the nature of the right, the importance of the purpose of limitation, and the nature and extent of the limitation, the relationship between the limitation and its purpose, and any less restrictive means reasonably available to achieve the purpose that the limitation seeks to achieve. End quote. Neither of these two charters are entrenched, and neither can directly invalidate legislation. But they do place some pre- and post-enactment requirements on the legislative branch to consider whether bills are in conformity with the charter. And they instruct courts to interpret ambiguous legislation with a conscious regard for the civil liberties provided. It is vital to remember that for the purposes of religious freedom, the word burden is best thought of as akin to interference or hindrance, and does not have to rise to the level of an absolute restriction. In other words, laws that make the exercise of religious beliefs more expensive, time-consuming, frustrating, and so forth, can be burdens for religious freedom purposes, even if those laws do not constitute a total ban. Courts rarely apply the exception for trivial or insubstantial burdens, in Canadian terms, in a broad way. After all, a petitioner would have had to already show some sort of injury or special interest in the issue to satisfy a judicial test of standing that are operative in each of the three countries evaluated in this chapter. A particular issue faced by SBNRs under this test is that because their beliefs are often perceived as lightly chosen and easily changed, courts may conclude that a legal restriction is not really burdening the individual at all. For example, courts sometimes, erroneously, apply the burden test as if only the exercise of religious activities mandated or required by an individual's religion were protected by the guarantee of freedom of religion. In the American case of Crafchow and Woodstock, for example, the court found that a city ordinance prohibiting the plaintiff from telling fortunes did not burden his freedom of religion because the plaintiff's sincere religious belief in teaching the Kabbalah to others did not have to be done through tarot card-based spiritual advice. Similarly, in Inri Bartha, a self-described Wiccan high priestess who believed she was divinely granted the gift of divination and that she could not refuse a request for spiritual advice, was told that a city ordinance banning fortune-telling for profit did not burden her religious beliefs because those beliefs did not require her to become a professional fortune-teller. These holdings seem clearly erroneous in light of the well-established principle in both the United States and Canada that freedom of religion protects religiously motivated conduct even if that conduct is not mandated or required by that religion. What matters is that there is a clear nexus between the religious belief and the conduct. From a legal realist point of view, the biggest hurdle faced by SBNRs in this context is not so much the formal doctrinal process of balancing, but the practical difficulty of convincing some judges that idiosyncratic spiritual beliefs are not trivial, that they are important and worthy of protection. If judges do not believe that these beliefs are serious, they will not conclude that an individual is burdened when those beliefs are restricted. This is an area where it is not so much legal principles that need to be changed, but courts and community perceptions of SBNRs. In conclusion, this chapter has analyzed, from a comparative perspective, the current state and future prospects of judicial protection of individualistic, idiosyncratic spiritual beliefs. These beliefs challenge the mainstream understanding of freedom of religion by forcing a re-evaluation of how religion is defined, how sincerity is understood, and how balancing is conceptualized. If it is true that, demographically speaking, SBNRs are becoming more and more present and visible in the West, then liberal democracies will have to consider how to accommodate them. The author's conclusion is that SBNRs can and do have a legitimate claim for their activities to be protected by constitutional and statutory guarantees of freedom of religion. Their beliefs, although unorthodox and more mutable than mainstream religious ones, are no less sincere and no less worthy of protection than anyone else's. In the spirit of tolerance and generosity that motivates the principle of religious freedom, we should include idiosyncratic spiritual beliefs under its rubric. Okay, so that concludes my paper. And what I thought I would do now is talk a little bit about Professor Movsesian's recent paper that just came out very recently, and then provide some thoughts about that. Professor Movsesian's paper, again, is titled The New Thoreaus. And the reference, of course, to Thoreau, you will have noticed in that major U.S. Supreme Court opinion that I cited and quoted, where the Supreme Court contrasted the sincere, organized, traditional religious beliefs of the Amish with someone like Thoreau's, according to the Supreme Court's, sort of individual philosophical, spiritual belief that do not constitute a religion. And in Professor Movsesian's article, especially this most recent one, which is, I think, more adversarial to protecting nuns under religious freedom than the 2014 article that I quoted in my paper, he argues that freedom of religious claimants, if their beliefs are individualistic and idiosyncratic in nature, should not be given solicitude by the courts under constitutional guarantees of freedom of religion in the United States. He argues that it is very important to understand religion as a community-oriented concept. He argues that the further away a belief is from traditional understandings of religion, the less likely courts should be to recognize it as religious for the purposes of constitutional interpretation. He expresses concerns about fraud from individual spirituality and religious nuns trying to gain special privileges or something like that. He talks about fear of what he calls administrative disorder, which is a type of argument, sort of the floodgates would open if SBNRs or religious nuns were recognized as having cognizable freedom of religion claims, that courts would be overwhelmed, statutes would be difficult to administer, and there would be severe problems. And he says that religious freedom is protected because we know that traditional religious believers have deep convictions rather than what may be with the so-called nuns or the SBNRs, simply they're passing whimsies. And so I guess my counter argument to that, and again, in an informal way, is that I think Professor Movsesian's view very much privileges the familiar and discriminates against the new and less institutionalist of beliefs. I think it makes a sort of ad hoc, somewhat arbitrary, somewhat special pleading type of argument. As the title of this podcast, it is a religious freedom for me, but not for thee sort of argument that I think is very problematic. As we see religion change and grow, I think our understanding of that concept needs to change and grow for legal purposes as well. I think one of the aspects of this, as I mentioned in my paper, is it makes religious freedom less valuable if religious freedom becomes associated only with a statistically shrinking number of adherents, especially in a country like Australia, for example, where now, according to the recent census, the nuns are the largest religious group in the country. So it's problematic from that point of view. I have the concern that, as I mentioned in my paper, is it turns a right freedom of religion that we've always understood as both an individual and an associational one into almost a purely associational one. And that's deeply problematic because the other rights that we recognize in the Bill of Rights, the U.S. Constitution, whether it's freedom of speech or the right to petition the government for the redress of grievances or the right to bear arms or the right to hold property, all of those have been understood as individual rights. We don't have to do those things in concert with anybody else in order to be protected by the Constitution. So I find it surprising that Professor Movsesian would single out freedom of religion for this notion that you can't have it on your own. You can only have it if you're part of a group that has it. I find that problematic. I find it also illogical in a sort of conceptual or broader philosophical sense to say that a right is not valuable or worth protecting if only one person has a particular belief, and that belief is only valuable if other people share that belief. In the sense that if one person has a belief, there's no protection, but if they persuade apparently one other person to share that belief, then two of them share it, and then they're an organization, and then their belief is protected. That seems to me like a bizarre sort of way to think of the situation, or thinking that if we want to draw maybe a polemical argument that Jesus Christ's freedom of religion would not be protected until he made disciples. It's sort of a strange way to look at the matter and why we protect freedom of religion to begin with, which is to protect conscience and the individual sort of most deeply cherished beliefs. Whether or not other people share those most deeply cherished beliefs, to me, are beside the point. I find the sort of floodgates argument, frankly, an intellectual lazy one. We see this sort of argument raised all the time in all sorts of situations, this fear that if any rule changes, then there's going to be a mass of litigants overwhelming the courts, disrupting the administrative system, and chaos and anarchy will be the result. We have seen no empirical evidence that this is a problem. And the courts in the U.S., as well as the other countries I'm talking about, are very well situated through a case-by-case basis to slowly and carefully address any problems that may come up if SBNRs are recognized as having the potential to make valid freedom of religion claims. I think the argument about SBNRs sort of choosing by whimsy their beliefs, and that's an argument why their beliefs should be less respected. Again, I think that is probably a sort of reductionist or a stereotypical belief. I think if you were to speak to many SBNRs, and this is my reading of the sociology of religion literature that does a lot of interviews with SBNRs, is that many of them have given tremendous deep thought to their beliefs and why they've assembled the beliefs they have from various traditions and philosophies and literatures and scientific principles and so forth. I think it's, again, reductionist to call it whimsy. And I would say for many SBNRs, there's a good argument that they spent a lot more time thinking about and weighing their beliefs and why they have those beliefs than we could say about very many members of mainstream religious organizations. According to the sociology of religious literature, one of the well-established principles is that demographically speaking, the best predictor of someone's religious affiliation is the religious affiliation of their parents or the community to which they belong. So one could easily argue that that shows we as individuals, for the most part, are not examining every religion available and making a choice amongst that. We are, in fact, adopting the religion of our parents because that's what we've been taught. So I think there's a good argument to be made that if anybody is exercising sort of conscientious choice amongst beliefs, it might be the SBNRs more so in some cases than some traditional members of religious organizations. I think, and this isn't a flaw in Professor Movsesian's paper alone, I would say, but there is an over-reliance on US Supreme Court doctrine as if it is the be-all and end-all of rational thought on the matter. These doctrines and these court cases that we're talking about are old cases. Most of them are rather ambiguous, could be read in different ways. And I think relying too heavily on them to sort of reach our conclusions is problematic. I think it's better to use them as useful tools and fact examples and analogies, but again, not to give them weight maybe greater than they deserve. And I suppose my final point will be the same sort of point I made in my paper, which is that we should approach freedom of religion in a generous and charitable way, and not have a religious freedom for me, but not for thee sort of mindset, that protecting conscience, protecting individual rights, individual choice, human dignity, all of those are deep arguments for extending the protection of religious freedom to SBNRs, even though we may have some concerns that there could be fraud, or maybe we think they're not taking their beliefs as seriously as some mainstream believers would. I think giving the benefit of the doubt would be the right thing to do. So that is, I suppose, my rejoinder, but I will want to emphasize that I very much appreciated Professor Movsesian's paper. It was very interesting and very well written, and I hope this is just one way to help continue the debate, and I look forward to seeing what comes out in the future. As I said, I will place these two papers and links to the Legal Spirits podcast in the episode notes for this episode. I very much thank you for listening. I know it was a longer episode and a little bit of a different episode in format than normal, but I'll be back again in 2 months with a return to the more traditional format and a special guest. Thanks very much for listening.